It is a very powerful, moving melody, and the words have such depth to them. My name is Rabbi Claude Scheiner. This is our home congregation. Although we live in Phoenix, Arizona, it's a long schlep. But we're really blessed to be here with everyone in our mishpacha, our family. I entitled this message, From Despair to Hope. It's an appropriate term, an appropriate topic. We just sang Hatikva, the hope. How do we get to the hope from its polar opposite, despair? Why would we be in despair anyway? Well, turn on the news. There's a lot of frightening things going on in the world today. And it's been going on, but it's getting worse and worse. No surprise to students of prophecy. There's a lot of, on the human level, a lot of reasons to be fearful, be anxious, and perhaps even experience some degree of despair about things. The Bible has a message for that. Now, it's especially difficult in our modern culture because in our culture we have developed what I call a point-click expectation about resolving things. Now, you'll forgive me if I betray my bias here. I look through the lens of my own experience. I've worked 30 years in the clinical world of counseling, so it's kind of the lens through which I see the scriptures speak. We have this point-click expectation. We have this need for immediate gratification. We have a low frustration tolerance. If we can't get an answer right that fast, we get panicky. It's gotten worse over the years. Now, I remember as a young boy sending away for something. How many of you know what I'm talking about? You know, I would find some little thing in the back of a comic book or a magazine, and something I wanted, and I'd cut it out, and I'd print my name and address, put it in an envelope with a quarter. Who does that anymore? And about a month and a half later, I'd get whatever it was, you know. But today, it's a radically different world. Today, when I want something, I sit there, I open up my iPad, I find it on Amazon, and we live in Phoenix where there's a distribution center. The next morning, it's on my doorstep. Whoa, you know, that's amazing. In some cases, it's same-day service. Well, as wonderful as that can be, it also feeds this immediate gratification thing. We have a time distortion in our culture today. Back in the 70s, there was a great book by Alvin Toffler called Future Shock. A few of you may remember that book. I think he even fell short of the expectation. I don't think he even saw this one coming. And so I'm going to share just a few scriptures on how to respond to this despair to hope dynamic. Next week, I'll be taking a kind of a secondary look at this topic from another vantage point, getting from anxiety to shalom. So this is kind of two standalone, but they're thematically related and linked. I'm going to begin with Psalm 40, verses 1 through 3. I waited patiently for Adonai till he turned toward me and heard my cry. He brought me up from the roaring pit, up from the muddy ooze, and set my feet on a rock, making my footing firm. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will look on in awe and put their trust in Adonai. Three simple verses in a relatively short psalm, but it's packed with profound truth. Have you ever been stuck in a muddy pit? Whether you were pushed, tripped, and fell, or you dug your own way in, doesn't matter. When you're at the bottom, it's a hard place to be. In the counseling world, we often tell clients, when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you have to do is stop digging. Don't make things worse. See, in the bottom of the pit, there is no sure footing. It's impossible to climb your way up and out. There's little light. There's no clear vision. The only thing you can see is the light from above. That's not a bad place to start, huh? Light from above. Now, when I was in the military, I was stationed on Guam 3 times, and one of the things I loved to do was scuba diving. And one time, my dive buddy Ed and I, we were going into a little offshore to a place called Billy Bay. They had these underwater caves. They're about 60, 70 feet down. And I thought it'd be cool to do cave diving. Yeah, I'm not thinking too clearly here. Well, it was kind of fun, you know. It was a big cave, and then it got narrower and got narrower, and it's a little twisty and turny thing. And then I passed this moray eel, which is kind of a vicious-looking thing with a whole lot of teeth. And they're territorial, so if you get in their space, they get a little aggressive. So I just went past that real quick, and then I hit a dead end. Uh-oh. Then I learned something interesting about the physics of scuba diving. Those fins you wear on your feet, they're only forward propelling only. You can't back up. Whoa, now what do I do? So I had to kind of crawl my way back, and I had to go past that moray eel. I go, oh, okay. So at least I turned my tank, so if he's going to bite, he's going to try to bite my steel tank. So I made it past that and got out of the cave and, you know, sucked the rest of my air out before I got to the top of the water. But it's that panic when you get in a situation and you can't figure out, how do I get out of this? It's a human thing. What 2 things did the psalmist do in this verse in Psalm 40? He waited and he cried. Now that doesn't sound very much like a macho alpha dog thing to me. He waited and he cried. We don't like the waiting part, do we? But sometimes, not always, sometimes God's processes are designed to challenge us, to change us, to grow us, and to conform us to Messiah. Now, we may not find the experience comfortable, but it's a necessary growth thing that the Lord allows in our life to cause us to grow. So he waited and he cried. What did the Lord do for the psalmist? Well, it says, he turned to him, he heard his cry, he brought him up from the pit, he set his feet on a rock, he made his footing firm, and he put a new song in his mouth. How cool is that? Where did the new song come from? From Adonai. Which begs the question, what was the old song? Woe is me, nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Poor me. Down in the valley, valley so low. Has your old song become a self-fulfilling prophecy? Are you still singing the old song? Maybe you need new lyrics. It can become a sense of negative reinforcement. I get, oh, it's just me again. Oh, it's just me. I'm doing the same old thing. What will be the results of the Lord doing these things for the psalmist? He will sing a song of praise to our God, and many will look on in awe and put their trust in Adonai. What's the new song? To God be the glory. It's a great song, but that's the type of song we're talking about. The new song that God puts in our heart, in our mouth, will manifest to other people the covenant faithfulness of our God. Now, what is your pit of destruction? What is your miry clay that you're stuck in? Could be employment issues, underemployment, unemployment, financial challenges, relationship problems, health challenges, fears, anxiety, stress, legal issues, maybe all of the above, I don't know. The question is, what are you doing about your situation? Now, what are you doing is my all-time favorite counseling question. I love that question. I'm far less concerned about what people are feeling. Doesn't mean I'm insensitive. It just means feelings are less important than what people are actually doing. Feelings follow doing. It's kind of like doing is the front wheels on your car. Feelings are the back tires. They'll follow wherever the front goes, right? So what are you doing about your situation? Maybe worrying and stressing? That's a doing behavior. Does worrying and stressing add to your life or take away? It takes away. Are you depressing? And I use the word here as a verb, as a conscious choice, to reduce sensory input. It's a temporary defense mechanism, I guess, but I'm not talking about legitimate chemical depression, which is a legitimate thing that can be treated chemically or with pharmaceuticals, but a lot of depression is just a choice to withdraw and isolate because there's just too much going on and I gotta calm down. In a temporary state, that's not a bad plan, but you can't live there. What are you doing about your situation? Avoiding it, either physically or perhaps chemically. And I worked for many years in the substance abuse world, and I know a few things about how people abuse substances to escape and chemically depart. Denying, manipulating people or situations. Are you always trying to manipulate everything to keep your world secure? Or bargaining with God? If blank, then blank. If God, you'll only do this, then I'll fill in the blank. That bargaining with God thing that we get trapped into. The question, all of these doing behaviors are things that are pretty common, and we've all done probably all of them at one time or another. The question is, are you doing what the psalmist did? Waiting and crying to the Lord. Those are the doing components in the psalm here. What can you expect the Lord to do for you because he did it for the psalmist? He'll turn to you. He'll hear your cry. He'll bring you up from the pit. He'll set your feet on a rock. He'll make your footing firm and put a new song in your mouth. You'll sing a new song of praise to our God, and many will look on in awe and put their trust in Adonai. Our lives are a testimony. The only question is, to what are we testifying? The frailties of our human flesh, or are we testifying to the covenant faithfulness of God? We're always testifying. We're always witnessing. We think of the term witness in this very narrow sense, like it's what we do when we go out to witness to people. You know, we use that in a very limited evangelistic, door-knocky, tract-handling type thing. The truth is, we're always witnessing. The question is, what is it that we are putting out there? Now, Romans 8:28 says, furthermore, we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called in accordance with his purpose. Do you love God? Are you called? Okay, you can claim this one then. Does it say that everything is good? No. But everything can work together for good, even what we would say are the bad things. And there are bad things that people experience. There are bad things that good people experience. It's not always a result of sin in your life or rebelliousness or whatever. It might be, but many times these things are allowed into our lives for a purpose, for a season, to season us perhaps. 1 Thessalonians 5:18 says, in everything give thanks. It doesn't say for everything, but in everything give thanks. For this is what God wants from you who are united with the Messiah Yeshua. So whatever circumstance we find ourselves, we can be thankful that God is with us, that he cares. And we're going to go into this a lot more next week. And that he is covenantly faithful to us. Now, when can you expect God to do this work in your life? Well, I like to answer questions with questions. Have you stopped doing that which is ineffectual and started doing what the psalmist did? Have you stopped doing all these ineffective things, waited patiently for God, and cried to Him? God really wants to hear from us. And we get so busy doing things ourselves, and He's thinking, like, okay, when are you going to talk to me about this issue? Okay, that was just one example in Psalms. There's a whole bunch. I'm going to talk about Psalms later on. But now I'm going to shift gears and go to a very exciting, dramatic chapter in Acts 27. And I'm going to read the whole chapter to you, because it is a very dramatic chapter. And forgive me if I take a little bit of liberty with applying this, but I think you'll see where I'm going. Acts 27. Once it had been decided that we should set sail for Italy, they handed Shaul and some other prisoners over to an officer of the emperor's regiment named Julius. We embarked in a ship from Adramyttium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of the province of Asia, and put out to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius considerately allowed Shaul to go visit his friends and receive what he needed. Putting to sea from there, we sailed close to the sheltered side of Cyprus because the winds were against us. Then across the open sea, along the coasts of Cilicia and Pamphylia, and so we reached Myra in Lycia. There, the Roman officer found an Alexandrian vessel sailing to Italy and put us aboard. For a number of days, we made little headway, and we arrived off Cnidus only with difficulty. The wind would not let us continue any farther along the direct route, so we ran down along the sheltered side of Crete from Cape Salmone. And continuing to struggle on, hugging the coast, we reach a place called Pleasant Harbor near the town of Lycia. Since much time had been lost and continuing the voyage was risky because it was already past Yom Kippur, Shaul advised them, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be a catastrophe, not only with huge losses to the cargo and the ship, but with loss of our lives as well." However, the officer paid more attention to the pilot and the ship's owner than to what Shaul said. Moreover, since the harbor was not well suited to sitting out the winter, the majority reached the decision to sail on from there in the hope of reaching Phoenix, another harbor in Crete, and wintering there where it is protected from the southwest and northwest winds. By the way, the majority is not always right. Remember Joshua and Caleb and the 10 spies? When a gentle southerly breeze began to blow, they thought that they had their goal within grasp, so they raised the anchor and started coasting by Crete close to shore. But before long, there struck us from land a full gale from the northeast, the kind they call an evrakelon. The ship was caught up and unable to face the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed into the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with strenuous effort to get control of the lifeboat. They hoisted it aboard, then fastened cables tightly around the ship itself to reinforce it. Fearing they might run aground on the Sirta sandbars, they lowered the topsails and they continued drifting. This make a great movie. But because we were fighting such heavy weather, the next day they began to jettison non-essentials. And the third day, they threw the ship's sailing equipment overboard with their own hands. For many days, neither the sun nor the stars appeared while the storm continued to rage until gradually all hope of survival vanished. It was then, when they had gone a long time without eating, that Shaul stood up in front of them and said, "You should have listened to me and not set out from Crete. If you had, you would have escaped this disastrous loss. But now, my advice to you is to take heart, because not one of you will lose his life, only the ship will be lost. For this very night there stood next to me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. He said, 'Don't be afraid, Shaul. You have to stand before the emperor. Look, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you.' So men, take heart, for I trust God and believe that what I have been told will come true. Nevertheless, we have to run aground on some island. It was the 14th night, imagine this, and we were still being driven about in the Adriatic Sea when around midnight the sailors sensed that we were nearing land. So they dropped a plumb line and found the water 120 feet deep. A little farther on, they took another sounding and found it 90 feet. Fearing we might run on the rocks, they let out four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight to come. At this point, the crew made an attempt to abandon ship. They lowered the lifeboat into the sea, pretending that they were about to let out some anchors from the bow. Shaul said to the officer and the soldiers, "Unless these men remain aboard the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut the ropes holding the lifeboat and let it go. Just before daybreak, Shaul urged them all to eat, saying, "Today is the 14th day you have been in suspense, going hungry, eating nothing. Therefore, I advise you to take some food. You need it for your own survival, for not one of you will lose so much as a hair from his head." When he had said this, he took bread, said the bracha to God in front of everyone, broke it, and began to eat. With courage restored, they all ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board the ship. After they had eaten all they wanted, they lightened the ship by dumping the grain into the sea. When day broke, they didn't recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a sand beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. So they cut away the anchors and left them in the sea. At the same time, they loosened the ropes that held the rudders out of the water. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and headed for the beach. But they encountered a place where two currents meet and ran the vessel aground on the sandbar there. The bow stuck and would not move while the pounding of the surf began to break up the stern. At this point, the soldiers' thought was to kill the prisoners so that none of them would swim off and escape. But the officer, wanting to save Shaul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to throw themselves overboard first and head for shore, and the rest to use planks or whatever they could find from the ship. Thus it was that everyone reached land safely. Where was Shaul going? He's going to Italy. Was it his choice? No. What did Shaul warn the centurions and the crew and the ship's crew about? He said, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be a catastrophe, not only with huge losses to the cargo and the ship, but with loss of our lives as well." They were in the midst of a humongous storm. Anybody in here ever been through a hurricane or a typhoon? Okay. Plenty of times. They are scary. I've been through a few of those. We lived on the island of Guam. I did 3 tours of duty over there. For those of you who are not familiar, LA to Hawaii is about 2,500 miles. And if from Hawaii, go another 4,000 and you might find Guam. A really small island out in the Pacific. It's only 8 miles by 26 miles. It's a little over 200 square miles. It's just out in the middle of nowhere. And I remember one time we had a typhoon come through, and which is not untypical. And a couple of days you get advance notice. The Naval Weather Service has this picture, satellite view. And because it's a satellite view from space, the island is so small they can't even see it. They have to put a little dot there to tell you, oh yeah, that's where Guam is. And they have this tiny dot in this gigantic storm, you know, hundreds of miles across, heading directly for us. And the first time I saw that, I'm thinking, oh boy. it's just gonna wipe us completely off and there's no place to go. I mean, this was huge. And for several days before the typhoon hit, everybody on the island was picking up everything possible, especially coconuts, because at 200 knot winds, they become missiles. And you have to board up everything. And of course, then the power goes out for a week or so. And you're relying on radio and all that. And It's a frightening thing. And that we lived across the street from the beach, and there was a cemetery there, and the pounding of the surf was driving caskets out of the ground. And the Guamanians and Filipinos were freaking out. It was unbelievable. I've never seen horizontal rain, true horizontal rain in my life. It was unbelievable. So I understand when they're talking about this kind of a ferocious wind, and to be at sea in it is even worse. We were scared on land, but I can't imagine going through something like that at sea. Now, few of us are in literal stormy weather with rain and wind like that. Some of us have experienced it. But many of us have social, personal, or emotional storms that hit us with the same level of ferocity. And we really get fearful. Some of these storms, they sweep down upon us and they threaten to swamp our little boat and sink us. What is your storm? You know, what are the storms in your life? Again, we go back to our list. Employment issues, financial challenges, relationship problems, health challenges. I've had a few of those. Fears, anxiety, stress, legal issues. Did you ever feel like the people on board that ship felt? It says in verse 20, "For many days, neither the sun nor the stars appeared, while the storm continued to rage, until gradually all hope of survival vanished." Didn't happen overnight, but the continuous storm, on again, on again, on again. Over time, the sailors lost a sense of time. They lost a sense of direction and navigation. They couldn't see the stars, so they couldn't navigate. And over time, they lost all hope of survival. Isn't that what happens to us when we get into these storms in our lives? We lose a perspective of time. We lose a perspective of where we're at, where we're going. And many times we lose all hope. Because in a human sense, we just can't see the way out. I think maybe we're not supposed to. I think maybe God allows these storms into our lives to create and foster a dependence on Him. So we can get to that same place the psalmist did, where we wait patiently and we cry to Him. He is our hope. Now, I asked the question earlier, did Shaul have a choice about being in the storm? Not really. Did he want to be in the storm? No. Would the storm have happened whether he wanted to be on that voyage or not? Yeah. Sometimes storms come into our life despite our decisions. So maybe we can take the false guilt off for a while. Because that's one of the things we typically do, isn't it? Like, oh, it's because I did this, or it's because I... Well, maybe not. Maybe it's none of the above. Maybe we can stop the false guilt. Sometimes our storms come without any of our doing and against our desires, but the storm would have been just as real if Shaul had desired to go on the ship. Now, how long did the storm last? Verse 27 said, "It was the 14th night, and we were still being driven about in the Adriatic Sea." That's the east coast of Italy, between Italy and the Balkans. "When around midnight, the sailors sensed that we were nearing land." Now, what did Shaul do after the storm had raged for many days? He said it was then, verses 21 through 26, "It was then, when they had gone a long time without eating, that Shaul stood up in front of them and said, 'You should have listened to me and not set out from Crete. If you had, you would have escaped this disastrous loss.' But that's history. But now, my advice to you is to take heart." Wow, what a positive message. "Take heart, because not one of you will lose his life. Only the ship will be lost. But this very night there stood next to me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. He said, 'Don't be afraid.'" Shaul, you have to stand before the emperor. Look, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. So men, take heart, for I trust God and believe that what I have been told will come true. Nevertheless, we have to run aground on some island. This is good advice, and this is timeless advice. Take heart, trust God, and believe. Not a bad place to be. In whom did Shaul place his confidence? In God. He trusted in the creator of the universe. Shaul had a vision from God that they would make it safely through the storm. Now, did anyone else on board have a vision that we know of? Doesn't say, does it? Probably not. What did they believe? Well, they were panicked. They wanted to abandon ship and kill the prisoners. Great. And what they tried human efforts and solutions. Now, I understand this. Now, I've done a bit of sailing, and I used to love sailing sailboats in San Diego and Guam. And in 1985, I entered a sailboat race, and I think it was 6 or 8 other sailboats, the Comnav Marianas Commodore's Cup. So we had 4 heats. We were sailing around buoys and all this, and it was fun. We had a blast, and I was a pretty good sailor. And I was skipper of the boat. Now, I was in a positioned in a good place to actually win this whole regatta. And we were on the ending of the 4th heat. I just passed the last marker buoy, and I was heading. And I looked up forward at the bow of the boat, and there's a little D-ring that holds the forestay to the bowsprit. Now, the forestay is a cable that runs from the bow, for you landlubbers, that's the pointy end in the front, from the bow all the way up to the top of the mast. That's what holds the mast up. I see this little D-ring pop and suddenly become bigger and bigger and became a C-ring. And I'm looking at this like, uh-oh, we're in trouble. Because if that goes, the mast is gone, you know. So I have my crewman take over the tiller. I crawl out on the bow. I put the sails wing on wing. I had the mainsail going starboard, and I had the jib going port. And I crawl under them, get up to the bow, and I lash the forestay down to the deck cleat through the D-ring as best I could, got back, took over the tiller, and I still had 3 boat lengths ahead of my competitor, and we crossed the finish line, and we took first place. And as soon as I did that, I turned into the wind to go to the dock, and the D-ring popped. My fix didn't hold, and down came the mast. And we were demasted, and the sails taken on water, and we're starting to capsize, and it got a little dicey, but we got into the... It was kind of a not very impressive showing at the end. But the point was, is we made it across the finish line, and we took first place. But right after that, you know, disaster happened. Well, I say this because I understand a bit about sailing and what happens when you're underway and stuff happens. And it does happen. I mean, it just happens. And so you do whatever you can do at the moment. You fix this, you do this, you jury-rig that. You know, you do whatever you got to do, you know, with what you have. But it also taught me a lesson about the limits of human effort, which has a spiritual implication to it. The human efforts that the sailors in our story tried, in verse 16, 17, that we managed with strenuous effort to get control of the lifeboat. They hoisted it aboard, then fastened cables tightly around the ship itself to reinforce it. Fearing they might run aground on the Sirte sandbars, they lowered the topsails and they thus continued drifting. And the third day, they threw the ship's sailing equipment overboard with their own hands. Verse 29, fearing we might run on the rocks, they let out 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight to come. As if praying is going to cause daylight to come sooner, right? At verse 30, at this point, the crew made an attempt to abandon ship. They lowered the lifeboat into the sea, pretending that they were about to let out some anchors from the bow. And in our story here, I think the lifeboat represents human efforts. Because they were told, stay with the ship. But they thought, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try this little maneuver here. I'm going to manipulate the situation. I got my own escape plan. Well, what are some of the things you've done to try to conquer your storm? Worrying, stressing? Somebody says, well, you know, worrying doesn't accomplish anything. Actually, that's not true. Worrying and stressing accomplishes a lot of things, and they're all negative. Worrying and stressing does not add to your life. It only subtracts. Depressing, avoiding, whether physically or chemically. Denying, manipulating people or situations, trying to manipulate everything all the time to keep things in your favor. Bargaining with God, we've talked about that. Have you ever wanted to run away from your storm? I'm going to take my little lifeboat and just run away from this place, this storm. Well, denial, avoidance. God forces the distress into the subconscious, but it doesn't make it go away. Procrastination. Now, there is a place and a time for delay. Delay can be wise if we are emotionally off-center and hyper-reactive. If I'm emotionally attached to a particular heavy decision, I will choose to delay making the decision for a day or two because I want to make sure that I'm approaching it rationally and not an emotional reaction. But that's not the same as procrastination, where we just keep putting it off and never deal with the issue. Maybe we run away from our storms by blame shifting. It's him, it's her, it's them, it's this or that, you know. We're all pretty good at that. Or minimizing or rationalizing. We come up with all kinds of excuses for things. Or we try the geographic cure. Oh, if I just move, that'll make everything better. Except when you move, you take you with you. And it's just there in a new place. Now, there is some value in a slight way of geographical cure, in the sense the people in the recovery community, I'm not a member, but I'm familiar with a lot of their terminology, they talk about avoiding people, places, and things. There's wisdom in that. If your contact with certain people or certain places or certain things is a threat to you, you know, avoiding that is probably healthy. That's just setting good boundaries. But I'm talking about the geographic here, like, oh, if I just pack up and go somewhere, all my problems are going to be gone. Nah, no. Or chemical abuse, drugs and alcohol. Now, what did the soldiers do to keep the sailors from running away? Shaul said to the officer and the soldiers, unless these men remain aboard the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut the ropes holding the lifeboat and let it go. We've already said the lifeboat in this example represents human efforts. How hard is it to let those things go? All those ineffective defense mechanisms and things that we get in the rut about, it's hard to let these things go. But let go we must. Does running away usually solve a problem? No. So what is Shaul counseling the men on board the ship to do? Verses 33 and 34, he said, just before daybreak, Shaul urged them all to eat, saying, today is the 14th day you've been in suspense, going hungry, eating nothing. Therefore, I advise you to take some food. You need it for your own survival. For not one of you will lose so much as a hair from his head. Now, what did the sailors see that gave them such hope? Verse 39 says, when day broke, they didn't recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a sand beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. How do you think they must have felt when they struck the sandbar? Safe at last? At least I can walk ashore from here? Sometimes our hopes get dashed when we place our hope in the wrong answer or solution. This is especially true in theology. Sound scholarship matters. The sailors tried to bring the ship to shore. They thought that was God's answer. Well, What will happen to your hopes if God does not solve your storm your way? Do we have a preconceived plan that we're trying to force God's hand to do it the way we think he should do it? And what happens when it doesn't happen that way? What happens to our faith then? I think some believers may shipwreck their faith by believing the pre-trib rapture theory, but that's another topic. So how did they get to shore? But the officer, wanting to save Shaul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to throw themselves overboard first and head for shore, and the rest to use planks or whatever they could find from the ship. Thus it was that everyone reached land safely. What had God told Shaul? In verse 24, he said, "Don't be afraid, Shaul. You have to stand before the emperor. Look, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you." In verse 34, he said, "For not one of you will lose so much as a hair from his head." It must have been very encouraging to Shaul to have that word. Has God revealed how he will solve your storm or problem? Sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. If not, what has he promised us? Now, this is not an exhaustive list. There are so many scriptures that deal with this topic. We could be here for 30 hours and Oneg would get cold and they'd start throwing things at me. But there's a few scriptures that are really important. Some promises from God. Psalm 28:7, "Adonai is my strength and shield. In him my heart trusted, and I have been helped. Therefore, my heart is filled with joy, and I will sing praises to him." Psalm 31:24, "Be strong and fill your hearts with courage, all of you who hope in Adonai." Psalm 40:1-3, this was our friend we started with. "I waited patiently for Adonai till he turned toward me and heard my cry. He brought me up from the roaring pit, up from the muddy ooze, and set my feet on a rock, making my footing firm. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will look on in awe and put their trust in Adonai." Isaiah 40:31 says, "But those who hope in Adonai will renew their strength. They will soar aloft as with eagle's wings. When they are running, they won't grow weary. When they are walking, they won't get tired." Philippians 4:19, "Moreover, my God will fill every need of yours to his according to his glorious wealth in union with the Messiah, Yeshua." Now, Yeshua's view of the Psalms is well known. In John 10:34, Yeshua quotes Psalm 82:6, describing the passage as written in your Torah. That's interesting. See, he's using a wider definition of the word Torah than we traditionally think the first five books of Moses. It's consistent with rabbinic understanding, too. Sometimes it's referring to the first five books. But sometimes it means Torah, meaning the entire Tanakh. From a messianic viewpoint, the apostolic writings have been given as Torah. And if we understand the word Torah, meaning teaching, instruction, we get it. We totally get it. The Psalms are quoted in the apostolic writings more than any other book. Do you know that? Isn't that amazing? The Psalms, it's an incredibly important resource. Why should we study the Psalms? I should say when we study the Psalms. When the seas in our life are smooth and calm, when we can provide quiet reflection and reassuring meditation, then the book of Psalms becomes ours. We internalize it, and it becomes a safe harbor when storms arise. It is what we study in a moment of sanity that we can pull out in a moment of insanity. I want to close with an introduction to a great book called Bringing the Psalms to Life. One clue to the power of the book of Psalms can be found in the life of a well-known contemporary hero of the Jewish people, former Soviet refusenik Anatoly Sharansky, who became Natan Sharansky when he emigrated to Israel in 1986. Sharansky had been held prisoner by Soviet authorities, detained in solitary confinement for years with nothing to read but his book of Psalms. When his release was finally negotiated and he was exchanged for a Soviet spy, Sharansky insisted on taking his book of Psalms with him, refusing repeated efforts by his former jailers to take it away from him. He carried Psalms with him as he crossed the bridge to freedom, held it aloft when he finally arrived in Jerusalem, and made his way with it directly to the Western Wall. Writing about his imprisonment, Sharansky's wife, Avital, said, "Anatoly has been educated to his Jewishness in a lonely cell in Chistopol prison, where, locked alone with the Psalms of David, he found expression for his innermost feelings in the outpourings of the King of Israel thousands of years ago. In his love of the Psalms and in finding his deepest feelings given voice in the Psalms, Sharansky was the embodiment of every Jew for the last 3,000 years and every Christian too. Somehow the Psalms put us in touch with what matters most to us and express those feelings more clearly and movingly than we can express them ourselves. More than any other part of Scripture, we can say that the Psalms are not beloved because they are holy, but they are holy because they are beloved. We do not turn to Psalms out of a sense of obligation. We read Psalms because they help us confront the pains and challenges that are part of every human life. Psalms help us put into words what we experience and feel. More than that, many will tell you, Psalms help us overcome our problems and bear the burdens that life places on all of us. What has made the Psalms so beloved and powerful is not their divinity, but their humanity. Psalms grew out of the soil of human experience. They talk to us in the voice of a fellow journeyer along life's path, and they have within them the resources to help us when the journey gets difficult. As we explore what the Psalms have to offer, our main goal is not to understand the world in which they were composed. Instead, we will read Psalms to find the light they can shed on our lives. In other words, we will study Psalms not to become experts in Psalms, but to let Psalms help us understand more about ourselves. In fact, we will strive to become friends with Psalms so that we can turn to them as true friends for help in our times of need. Each of us brings our own particular experience to everything each of us does. Our histories and struggles shape the way we see our world and the way we understand everything we study. No book of the Bible lends itself as much as Psalms does to being read through the lens of our own circumstances and search. The book of Psalms talks to our spiritual quest, our desire to find God, and our frustration that God often seems remote, hidden, unapproachable, and unknowable. Psalms talks to human pain, illness, and fear, and to the sense that we sometimes have of being abandoned. Psalms knows the sting of failure and the distress of being betrayed by people we trusted. Psalms can be the voice through which we cry out for help, and Psalms can be the guide through which the lost begin to be found. My suggestion to you is to make friends with the book of Psalms. It's not a theology lesson, although you can learn a lot of good theology there, but that's not the purpose. It's very similar to a siddur that has rote prayers, and some of those prayers have so much beauty and depth and expression in our prayer life. They're wonderful prayers. It's the same with the book of Psalms. When we're praying to God and we want to cry to God from our heart, and we don't even know what to say sometimes, Say the book of Psalms. Find the Psalms that speaks to your heart. They can become your vehicle for transmitting what's truly going on inside to our Heavenly Father, and he so longs to hear from us. Shabbat Shalom.